Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
What if there was a way to level up your energy, get rid of stress, and take more control of your body? Welcome to Quantum Upgrade. This is a new technology that taps into quantum energy to help you feel amazing. Quantum Upgrade has a lot of different products that help protect you from EMF and help activate your body's natural healing abilities. You can expect better sleep, more resilience, less stress, and better blood flow. The cool thing about Quantum Upgrade is that the products are backed by a lot of heavy-duty scientific studies, and there's a new measurable upgrade. You can now use Quantum Upgrade to increase your consciousness levels between 1400 and 2200 on the Hawkins map of consciousness. If you don't know what that means, do some research because it's impressive, it's fun to learn about, and it's something that I've come to understand. Ready to try Quantum Upgrade? Visit quantumupgrade.io/Dave for a 7-day free trial. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Hey everyone, it's Dave Asprey with Bulletproof Radio. I'm recording live for this episode, which is awesome. I'm doing it here at JJ Virgin's event called Mindshare in Tampa, Florida. And today's cool fact of the day is that where you live, how you grow up, the culture you're in actually changes your brain. It changes the way you see the world. And if you look at people who grew up in Western cultures, then we're going to look at what's right in front of us. We're going to focus on the object. But if you grew up in an Asian or an Eastern culture, you're much more likely to look around you and to look at the context and the situation around. So you have a broader focus versus a narrower focus. And I don't think there's a way to say that one is better than or more useful than the other. They're just different. So your cultural view changes your brain scans. And you can actually figure out that people from different cultures recruit different parts of their brains to process the same picture. So this is fascinating and stuff that we never would have known if we were just a bunch of cavemen sitting in caves. At least I wouldn't imagine as much.
What if there was a way to feel younger for longer? Well, there is. Your body needs something called the NAD plus molecule to help you age well. When you're young, your body makes a lot of NAD plus, and that helps you make energy. It helps you keep your DNA healthy, absorb nutrients well, and it protects your cells from stress. But once you hit about 30, your NAD plus levels start to drop. The good news is that longevity scientists have found some things that can help, like niacin, niacinamide, and niagen. They help your body make more NAD plus even as you age. All three of these are in an amazing formula called Qualia NAD plus. Check out Qualia NAD plus risk-free for up to 100 days at neurohacker.com/Dave15 to save an extra 15%. That's neurohacker.com/Dave15, Qualia NAD plus. It's what I use.
Today's guest is an amazing entrepreneur. His name is Jeff Hayes. And Jeff is a filmmaker, but he's also raised $100 million in venture capital and started companies like Deals That Matter, Next Fitness, Pod Fitness, Zingback, and a bunch of others. So this is a chance for us to learn from someone who has succeeded multiple times, failed multiple times, and made some kind of cool movies, including one called On Native Soil and one called Doctored, that looks specifically at what happens with the American Medical Association and doctors in the U.S. So there's some health-related stuff, there's some performance-related stuff, but mostly Jeff has just had a lifetime of ass-kicking, and I want to know how he did it so you guys can learn. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So tell me about how you started as an entrepreneur.
You know, it's funny. My sister's been a professor at a medical school for 25 years, has a PhD, all the education, I'm a high school dropout. I didn't have the right altitude for high school. My attitude was okay. I'm 56, so if you put this in a time frame, my altitude was bad for high school. And so I evolved. When I was 18, I was a door-to-door encyclopedia salesman.
Wow.
And I was so dumb, I thought that was a good job. You know, I literally did that for a couple of years. And, you know, you learn a lot, but that, starting there, the natural evolution to an entrepreneur, I closed other doors to myself that, you know, by not having an education. But the reality is life was perfect. It was a long road with a lot of damage and a lot of wreckage and a lot of success. But it was a really natural evolution to starting businesses due to lack of being able to do anything else.
So necessity is the mother of invention.
In me it was. I was also predisposed. One time I got interviewed at the University of Utah, their business school, and they said, can entrepreneurship be taught? And my thought was, absolutely, as long as you're teaching it to an entrepreneur. And it's like, so there's lots of stuff you need to know. But you have to have the right mindset. You know, I remember being 7 years old and having a toy sale. Everything was marked down to a dime. And my mom comes home and it's like, the stuff she had just given me, you know, it's like, it's all a dime. The kids are in the neighborhood are running over and I'm selling stuff that I'm sure they paid significant money for. Everything's a dime. It worked for the five and dime store. It worked for me. I sold seeds. And that's where I learned the difference between gross and net. Where back then you could order seeds from the back of Boy's Life magazine, they'd send them to you, and your dad's on the hook to pay for the seeds. They send the seeds out, and the kid goes out and sells them. So I go out and sell all the seeds and spend all the money, not understanding, oh, I'm supposed to pay for the inventory. And so, you know, I learned an entrepreneurial lesson of, okay, there's a difference between gross and net. So there's no question that I was predisposed to do this. But the entrepreneurial path, right now our education system isn't set up to teach it. There's it comes from people like you that are front runners that turn around and go, okay, they're bridge builders that say, okay, this is the way I went. This is what other people are doing. The road to success is through failure, but it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be your failure. In my case, my road to success definitely, you know, passed through lots of my own failures.
I never understood until probably I was about 30 that people, at least some people, actually really just want to help, and like that's a reward in and of itself. So I definitely made a lot of my own failures because I wouldn't listen to anyone. I was advice resistant. As a young man, because I figured I had to do it all myself, like I would know best, and you could say even mistrustful. And I found, even now, I work with some young entrepreneurs, and probably 4 out of 5 of them are like, they'll hear the advice, and then they'll go out and they'll walk into a buzzsaw. And like, I told you there was a buzzsaw there, but they do it anyway. That one that doesn't, those guys are kicking ass before they're 25.
You can feel, when you talk to somebody, and you watch their, you know, and especially one that's really common amongst entrepreneurs who have a creative mindset is we tend to be doing 5 or 6 projects or 10 at the exact same time. And anybody will tell you, you know, that if you want to magnify something, you do it by subtracting. Mm-hmm. And if you want to multiply something, you do it by dividing, you know, like a cell multiplies by dividing. If you want to magnify it and increase your chances of success, you subtract everything else until that's the only thing in focus, and then you magnify that. And you tell somebody like me that, and you watch their face glaze over and go, yeah, but I'm not giving up these other things I'm doing. And you just go, okay, welcome to your own personal buzzsaw. This is the other thing that when we listen to an expert, we have 2 criteria. One is we want to know, does this person know what they're talking about? And then number 2, what are their motives? And so, like, I've seen you at conferences. I'm very familiar with, you know, I started drinking Bulletproof coffee a year and a half ago, after 20 years of no coffee, now wow. I'm a fiend. You know, so I'm not even going to thank you. It's like, I enjoy it, but it's still, it's like, you know, this, I'm like, okay, I'll do this every now and then. But every now and then means all morning and into the afternoon. But I didn't trust you until I read your book.
Oh, thank you.
Once I started reading the book, I'm like, okay, I get it. This guy knows what he's talking about. But because it took me to separate you from other experts, does this, you know, so I had no problem with your motive, but the question is, does this guy really know what he's talking about? And the book goes into enough detail and your own personal history, I go, okay, I get it. By the way, just a complete side note, the single smartest thing, and I send out 20 to 40 books a month to friends. I buy books, and whatever the best book I read last month, I'll send out. And the single smartest thing I read last year was you saying, we've got to quit saying fruits and vegetables like it's one word. I quote that. I no longer give you credit. I say that, and it's like, but the first few times I gave you credit, you know, but now I just said, but literally, that's so true in our, you know, fruits and vegetables, like they're one thing and they're radically different. That single message could probably, if we could just get that phrase spread through the culture, we could probably affect diabetes in this country.
Yeah.
By people thinking they're doing the right thing, you know, by hammering down a bunch of sugar every day in the form of fruit.
Well, thank you for that. I didn't even know you'd read my book, so I appreciate
it. By the way, I haven't finished it yet, so okay. I guess it's strategically placed where I read it maybe 5 minutes a day, and I don't want to go into detail where.
It's a good place for it.
But it's guaranteed to be finished, and it's likely to be one of my books I send out to friends.
Oh, I'm honored, actually.
You're honored that, well, right
there. You'll send it to your friends. The other part.
There's an image nobody wants.
It's funny how language affects things, and you mentioned the fruits and vegetables coming together. In your time as an entrepreneur, has language, the way you're approaching yourself from, you know, associating words that are unrelated or other things like that, language of success, language of failure, is that something that comes up for you, or is that something that wasn't a big deal?
So I got certified in neuro-linguistic programming.
There you go.
In the 80s. And so we used to call people meta monsters who learned the meta model from NLP and then took it too far. So I was a meta monster.
What is NLP? If people who are watching or listening right now, oftentimes in their cars, if they don't know NLP, can you just define it for a minute?
So neuro-linguistic programming was where Tony Robbins started, and it was the study of how language affects your neurology. And I started studying it in the 80s, really to learn how to be a better salesperson.
Mm-hmm.
But it became much more than that for me. It was... it affected every area of my life.
So I read the original, what's the guy's name, Barlow, the original NLP things back in the 90s, and honestly, I couldn't make heads or tails of it at the time. I'm aware of neuro-linguistic programming techniques. I don't consciously use them. And you can tell when someone's misusing it because it's like they're talking in a funny way that they want to be manipulative. So you're
talking about Bandler.
Yeah, thank you. Bandler, that's the guy.
And this was stuff. And then Bandler is who I trained with. And
you trained with Bandler himself?
Yeah, okay. So I went and did my master certification with him in 89. But the stuff, it was very manipulative. And then people kind of gave it more authority than what it really had. And so as if you can drop these hidden language bombs and people lose their power of choice. So it was a therapeutic way of speaking that was effective. But the main thing that it taught me was the power of language and the power of language on my own neurology. And now it's so ingrained on me, I don't remember to use it or to not use it. If I want to create mental images in your mind that are movies, if I say to you, can you think of a time in the past that you ran to the store? You're going to get a still image. If I say, you know, can you think of a time in the past where you were running to the store? The choice of it, now you're going to get a movie when I say that.
Run versus we're running. Changes the brand.
So, you know, can you think of a time you ran? Boom, there's a still image. Can you think of a time where you were running to the store? And so that distinction between those two past tense ways of stating something, I can literally choose words that cause different images in your mind. And so we react to these images in our mind. So it has an effect, but it is not the, you know, Svengali, you know,
puppet master kind of thing.
And the main thing is learning how to talk to yourself, what to say to yourself, and what not to say to yourself, and to start to edit your own language. It's funny, Dan Sullivan, who coaches entrepreneurs, says,
me too. I'm a client.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I've never heard this concept that an entrepreneur's job is to protect our confidence.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I had to go, what did he just, you know, to protect your confidence? Because I've always, you know, been, I got to tamp down my confidence. I think I'm capable of too much. I want to take on the world. I think I can do great things. And it's a little bit unrealistic thinking that entrepreneurs suffer from. And he points out, if you're in flow, when you're confident, that's when you do great stuff. Yeah. And so, no, this is not a bad thing. And I have to protect it from other people who want to bring us down. You know, Dave, what makes you think you can have a bestseller? You know, get back in your box where I'm comfortable keeping you. And you go, no, I'm going to have a New York Times best-selling book, and I'm going to build a brand. You know, that Dave, you know.
There's a phrase in Chinese, the only phrase in Chinese I know, by the way, but it's Ni Shi Shama Dong Shi. And I'm sure I said that really bad. All my Chinese listeners right now are going, like, they're throwing food at the camera. Sorry, people. But it means, who do you think you are, roughly?
Isn't that the best?
And like, people say that to their kids. And I'm like, I would never do that, but we get that ingrained, right?
Yeah, who do you think you are? And it's never, who do you think you are? I wish we'd use that when somebody's speaking ill of themselves. It's like,
oh, that's brilliant.
Because it's a neutral question. Who do you think you are? Do you not understand? You're a world beater. You're a champion. Yeah.
So how did you change your way of relating to yourself? I mean, did that make you a better entrepreneur, or was it all through the NLP training that you became aware of that?
So it's funny, because I came from a lack of education, I have spent the rest of my life gathering an education. And, you know, even like where you and I are now, you know, we're spending our weekend learning more, doing more. I'm 56. I assume 25 years from now, I'm going to be sitting in a room somewhere learning how to be more, contribute more, do more, give more, have more. So it's just a never-ending process.
So part of learning as an entrepreneur is failure. What's your biggest failure?
Oh. You know, this is like, this goes on, the list goes on and on. You know, I had, in the .com area, we raised $75 million in venture capital for one company that we later sold for $10 million.
Ouch.
So it was a fairly spectacular torching of capital. But those aren't the ones that bother me. You know, what bothers me is when I've started projects and gathered people around me and said, follow me, I'll take you to the top of the mountain. And I get us halfway to the top, and everybody's killed on the side of the mountain. And so friends, neighbors, relatives, people who bought into my ideas, one of the key things I've learned about being an entrepreneur is, you know, this new lean methodology of minimum viable product, validating your, you know, I used to go out and raise all the money, and then we would find out if our concept was valid. And it never is. There's always, you're going to have to pivot along. And so then you can never go back and go, okay, investors, you know, let's quit. And so you got a ring in your nose, and then you start the process of trying to pivot into success while projecting confidence, while raising more money. And this led to some spectacular failures. And so they were smaller, but devastating, you know, where I damaged relationships. I have one good friend who lost money in a company of mine, and he goes, Jeff, nobody has ever worked harder at losing my money than you.
Still a good friend, I'm
saying. Yeah, because he saw, you know, I put my heart and soul into it. But now the real distinction, the thing that could have avoided a lot of that, is validate the concept before you get too much of other people's money into the project.
Are you a fan of Patrick Blaskowitz?
I don't know the name.
He's one of the big authors in the Lean Startup community. Yeah. I figure you might have come across his stuff. Also a friend.
I will now.
Yeah, I'll send you info on his book, and we'll post that in the show notes, too, if this is the kind of thing you're interested in. So I think that this new idea of crowdfunding startups, and plus just changes in the cloud, I look at what I've done with Bulletproof Exec, and I used to, for a living, put together professional services engagements to make websites. And I would design the architecture, like the full redundancy, all this stuff, at the company that really created modern cloud compute called Exodus Communications. So I would literally quote $1 million setup and roughly $100,000 a month of operational stuff for what happens somewhere with Bulletproof, and I can tell you, I don't know what state my content's in. I don't care. I'm not even on Amazon Web Services, and I'm like an original cloud, OG cloud gangster or something. And like, it's so cheap now that I also don't know how much I spend on hosting because it's like $1,000 or something. And this is a substantial website, like very substantial. So all of those things have gone into making lean startups, making rapid prototypes happen, but the funding side was still broken. And now we've got just basically crowdfunding things. What's your take on crowdfunding? How do you use it? Like, what do you think about it?
Amazingly enough, I'm one of the world's experts on crowdfunding. Yep. Forbes did an article about me, and I've done close to $2 million in crowdfunding. I've done now a dozen successful crowdfunding campaigns. And when I say I'm one of the world's experts, what I'm really saying is I'm king of the midgets. There are no experts in this. Yeah. You know, this existed a couple of years ago. And so it's funny, I'll get interviewed on crowdfunding podcasts and crowdfunding shows, and I'll be talking to the host, and it was like, you know, he's got some crowdfunding site, and I go, man, this is great. What projects have you done? And they're like, well, I've consulted on it. And I go, well, yeah, but which ones have you done? And well, no, I've never actually crowdfunded myself. And it's like all the guys out there coaching and doing things, not all, surely somebody else is, but there's nobody who's actually done crowdfunding that's teaching crowdfunding. You know, there's consultants who consult on 200 crowdfunding campaigns and 4 succeed, and they talk, you know, they're tout those 4. But this to me is a staggering shift in access to capital for entrepreneurs. And so crowdfunding, you have the equity side, which is not my interest. It's regulated. It's
annoying.
It's not the direction I want to go.
So if you're listening to this and you're not into crowdfunding in business, what we're talking about is a whole bunch of people each put in $20 to get something they really want, even if they don't get it in a year. And if enough people put the money in, then you build the thing.
That's really, so gathering the first, this donor crowdfunding is brilliant, and it now you can validate your concept, you can test your language, you can find out, and you know, if you should do this project at all, and then you can raise your initial money. And so, like, I've got a crowdfunding campaign that, as of this minute, I said it on just a small project on a film I'm going to re-edit for a specific group. We set it at 50,000. We went over 50,000 this morning. It'll probably close at 75,000, and I put this together in a day, and you know, over 45 days, added 75,000 to something that we'll fund, and I'll make money on once it's finished. And this is I can't imagine not having at least one crowdfunding campaign going all the time.
It seems like you're in an ideal space because you've been an entrepreneur, you know all the pieces that go into building a company, and then you transitioned over to being a filmmaker, and crowdfunding is about perfect for films because they're digital, because you might sell a lot more films after it's done, but everyone who puts money in is getting a copy of the film.
Yep.
So it's a digital product.
And there's other things I can do. The key to crowdfunding, my business model on films, Jeff Hayes Films, our tagline is movies that make movements. So I don't make a film because it's a great story. The criteria is I want to make a profit and I want to make an impact. So movies that make movements. And so that means I don't make films I want to make. I make films that other people want made. I give a voice to people who have no voice. And so this is key to the crowdfunding. You don't fund the project you want to do.
Yeah.
You fund a project that there's a crowd that wants done. And if there's no crowd, maybe you shouldn't do the project. It's a great place to find that out. But if you approach it from that standpoint, there were a lot of people who wanted a Pebble watch. And you know, their goal was 100,000 and they raised 10 million. Who knew? There were a lot of people that wanted an updated cooler. And suddenly $13 million of a cooler.
Yeah.
You know, this so crowdfunding something like this, and what it really allows you to do is sell your product before it exists. I can sell a film before I've shot one frame of film. The other thing I did with the movie Bought that I just am just releasing, we did four crowdfunding campaigns for one film.
Wow, four different ones.
I know,
different stages or what?
Yeah, different stages. So nobody's ever done it before. The one of the founders of Indiegogo goes, well, I didn't know you could do four campaigns for one film. But because I'm one of the world's experts on crowdfunding, we're redefining what this is. But the thing about a film is at each stage, you know, when I did the first campaign and raised a couple of $100,000 for this film, we hadn't shot anything. Well, now with a few $100,000, I can start filming and I can start releasing. And so now I can run another campaign and say, look what we've got. And at each stage, I've got something to show. And so sequencing these campaigns, nobody had done before. But literally, we went, instead of one campaign that did $200,000, we ended up raising close to $700,000 in four campaigns, which the money was just there by going after it.
So I'm now feeling like I probably have made some suboptimal decisions at this point. So my first documentary, Moldy, about environmental toxic mold, and I just funded it myself. I'm like, okay, I've been fortunate. I've sold some coffee. I'm going to take the profits from the coffee, and I'm going to pour it into a problem that I know genetically affects 100 million people. And my goal is to once a year make a movie about something that affects 100 million people that they have no idea about.
It's a great idea. It's a noble, but let me encourage you to not use your own.
And I'm going to crowdfund the next one.
Well, yeah, because it's not just the money. It's like, once I finish the film Bought, now I have about 8,000 people that have joined me that want to see this out there. So when we now are going to offer the film, I already have several thousand affiliates that were built from the community that we built through crowdfunding. And we have, we're not entering the market brand new. So like you entered the market with Moldy. Nobody had heard of it. And again, it's very noble that you're doing this, but you did. And then what you can do, what I like to do, if you have money you're willing to contribute to that, put it up as matching funds.
That's a great idea.
And you go, okay, our budget for this is $200,000. For every dollar that comes in, I'll match it dollar for dollar up to $100,000. So your contribution.
Thank you. You just made this interview way more valuable going this way.
Yeah,
seriously.
Yeah, it'll be $100,000 next year. And it builds your group, it builds your community, and it allows people to participate in a noble cause. It's like, okay, wait a minute. You've convinced me enough on the mold issue. I would like to participate. I don't want to write a check for $100,000, but I'll write a check for $100,000, and I'll join you in this fight.
Wow. You've really, really helped me. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Tell me more about Bought.
So Bought, when I did the film Doctored, it was about the AMA and how the AMA systematically tried to get rid of alternative medicine, especially chiropractic. And this is not like web rumors and stuff. This is actually five chiropractors in 1974 sued the AMA in a David and Goliath story. It took 15 years. Went to the Supreme Court, but the AMA was found guilty of conspiring to contain and eliminate the chiropractic profession. And so in the process of telling this story, we kept running across two issues that we didn't know what to do with, and that was GMOs and vaccines. And people would be like, oh, you're going to cover vaccines, aren't you? And I'm like, what's the problem with vaccines? And it turns out a lot of chiropractors are anti-vaccine. I'm like, why would you be anti-vaccine? And then the GMO issue. So we tapped into these a little bit, enough to know there's a lot of controversy in each one. And on the GMO side, how do we make a film about health and not cover food? So yeah. We mentioned both of these, but this, so bought, we dug into big pharma, GMOs, and vaccine dangers. And it's funny, in this country, you can't be, if you'd like to say, I would like to see about making vaccines safer, you can't have that conversation. You're either anti-vaccine or you're pro-vaccine.
Yeah.
And it's an incredibly radioactive subject. We filmed at Harvard, we filmed at MIT, we filmed at University of Purdue, the University of Wales. The film opens with a woman who's a neuropsychologist, PhD, talking about her vaccine-damaged child who had, at 6 months, was damaged by the pertussis vaccine, brain encephalitis. And the camera pulls back, and she's sitting next to her now 20-year-old son wearing a seizure helmet and a diaper. She's a neuropsychologist. She went through, and in 1986, Congress made it illegal to sue a vaccine manufacturer.
What the hell?
But it's funny, and it was with good intent. The vaccine manufacturers went to Congress and said, because vaccines are inherently and unavoidably unsafe, we're getting out of the business unless you give us liability protection. So to stop them from leaving that business, we gave them blanket protection, and we set up what's called Vaccine Corp, but it's the Vaccine Injury Compensation System. And it was designed to quickly get money to people whose child was damaged, because it's going to happen. Vaccines are inherently and unavoidably unsafe. Once we did that, this weird bureaucratic bastardization happens, and suddenly the vaccine program becomes more important than the children that it was designed to protect. So it takes like 7 years to go through the vaccine injury compensation system, and the odds are two-thirds against you that you will win. You're suing the United States government. So here's this woman that she and her husband are both advanced degrees, have good incomes. They go through 7 years of hell with everybody, her doctor on the day that it happened, oh, this is a vaccine injury, everybody agreed, and it still took 7 years of fighting, but the government found his autism and mental retardation were caused by vaccines. So the film opens with a woman where a lot of times they're dismissed, oh, she's just a mom, she doesn't know what she's talking about. Well, here's just a mom who, of course, got divorced in the process of this, 95% lose their marriage. A neuropsychologist, educated, smart, intelligent, with a child who lost that life at 6 months, that now 20 years later, he's in a seizure helmet and a diaper. It makes it very difficult to say, no, this doesn't happen, when especially when the government said yes, and they paid her $8 million over that child's lifetime in an annuity to take care of him. But it was a bitter, horrible experience, and this is going on all the time. Once you dig into it, and then we find that we're being lied to about the safety and efficacy of vaccines, people... this year's flu, the flu vaccine, the Cochrane Commission has reviewed it three times and said they just don't work. There's no benefit. There is a downside. This year, the CDC came out and said, okay, we admit it, this year doesn't work, but still get it.
You can still buy it at Walgreens.
Even though it doesn't work, please still get it. You really still need it. And so it's time to have the purpose of this film, and I'm thinking about running a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal. I got to decide whether I have the guts to do that. I've done this three times in my career where I run full-page ads in the Wall Street Journal.
And that's like hundreds of thousands of dollars, right?
We got them on a remnant rate, and you can do it for less than that, but it's still quite... I ran one for Pod Fitness, a company that I had that said, Dear Steve Jobs, thanks for the iPod. P.S. Wait till you see what we do with it. Call me, and had my cell number. The next day, Apple sued me over the name Pod. It cost me $1 million for that lawsuit.
That's ballsy, though.
So that's my mentality, is find the biggest guy on the field and go stick your finger on his eye. So I'm going to run an ad in the Wall Street Journal. We'll see if I have the courage to do it. Say, and the headline being, is it time to short Merck and Monsanto, botmovie.com? And see if we can... Because
it's brilliant marketing. Whether or not you do it, you have to do it.
That's what I think too. So we'll see if I survive the doing it. But this this film, we need to get it out there to start the conversation, to let people know, GMOs, it's a contentious subject. The bill that failed in Washington State, there was $12 million that was spent fighting that bill. Of the $12 million, $500 of it came from inside Washington State. That all but one contribution in the entire state, everything else came from business interests outside of the state that literally bought that vote. And that's...
So bot's about that, or is bot about vaccines?
So bot is about vaccines, GMOs, and big pharma. So we have two big pharma whistleblowers,
okay,
both of whom, their cases have already been settled for billions of dollars. And so these guys went through hell. It turns out it's the same culprit in bot. It is the same people doing GMOs, vaccines, and big pharma. It's the same shareholders, the same companies.
So... The most important thing that you've said in the thing about vaccines is that this group says they're more is better and they're all evil, and the middle is a wasteland.
You're not even allowed to have that conversation.
Yeah.
It's like, no, which side are you on? And you're like, well, I'm on the side that would like to see these be safer.
Yeah,
I'm on the side
that middle.
Would like to see, we've never done a test of what happens to a kid that you give all of these to. We've never done the study that tracks people who've been vaccinated versus people who haven't. The CDC said it would be immoral to do that study. I promise you, I could get 1 million people to volunteer their children for that study. They said, well, vaccines are so important, we can't do the study. We can even do it retroactively and follow the kids that we know haven't been vaccinated versus the kids.
Amish.
So, yeah, so they don't want to know the answer to this question, and that's the part that, most of the people, most of the MDs that really dig into it become anti-vaccine. If I was headed back to Africa, I would struggle, do I get the yellow fever or not? It's a dangerous vaccine. Yellow fever is a dangerous, so it'll aggravate people that, that I have an open mind on this stuff. I don't know what I would do.
I'm in the same boat. My wife's a Karolinska-trained physician, and she volunteered for Doctors Without Borders. And when she got the round of vaccines required for Africa in med school, she got encephalitis. She had to take a semester off because her brain was gone from the vaccine.
And it
caused autoimmune issues that she still has. And she knows it happened. There's no lawsuits. It's in Sweden. They don't sue anyone in Sweden. But the thing is, to say that they're all harmless, no. But there is a benefit to some of them. And that's where it gets really weird. If I went to Africa, I don't know what I'd do either.
This is when, at the very beginning, I talked about experts. We want to know, do they know what they're talking about? And what are their motives? And most of these conversations on GMOs and most of these conversations on vaccine are fueled by people with bad motives. And that distorts the conversation. So that's the purpose of the independent documentary filmmaker like me, is I wade into these conversations with hopefully no agenda other than shining a light on them. I usually end up with a bit of an agenda, but I don't start with one.
Now, you did something, it sounds like it's in your personality, but you didn't just pick one thing to go up and poke in the eye, but you picked GMOs and vaccines
at
the same time. So the two-fingered poke.
Aren't
you just going to get sued or killed or something?
I hope not. This is strategic in that what I wanted to do for the vaccine group, the GMO people are scared to associate with the vaccine people. They believe in it. They want... Jeffrey Smith is one of the big voices in anti-GMO.
He's a friend.
But he didn't have I don't want to say courage. I'm frustrated with him that when it came time that because it will hurt his movement, he made the rational decision to not participate in this because he can't afford to be associated with the vaccine movement. And it's very frustrating to me. I need these guys to stand together. At the same time, when I talk to him, I get it. Literally, had he been associated to this, it could drop his funding and jeopardize his entire organization for his mission. But these guys need to know, I want to knit them together because they belong together and they're fighting the same villain. whether that'll be successful, I don't know.
The big villain we're talking about here, it's funny, I mean, you've taken on other big regulatory bodies as well. And what we're talking about here is when large organizations with an agenda put themselves in charge of your choices, we tend to run into this behavior. And I'm not fully convinced that it's always with negative intent. I think there's always good intent when it's set up. It's an emergent behavior of lots of small decisions.
Werner Erhard said all organizations eventually turn evil. And what he means evil is when the organization starts to serve itself instead of serving the people that it was set up to help. The vaccine injury compensation system was set up to serve people who are injured. You know, we started this, we set up the protection, liability protection, because it was in our best interest. There was no evil, you know, somebody twirling their mustache. The same thing, farmers are trying to get better yields. And so Monsanto is trying to serve their customer, the farmer, and even restaurant. If you and I opened a restaurant, we wouldn't go, tell you what, let's have okay food. We shouldn't have great food because people will eat too much. So, you know, we start down this trail of making our food as great as it can be. The next thing you know, there's food scientists who figure out how to manipulate the flavors, how to keep it in your mouth longer so it stays on your tongue, so you absorb more of the fat and are happier and more satisfied with the meal, get hungrier, more salted. We do all this. It's not out of evil. We want to have the best restaurant we can have, but we end up a long way from where we started.
Yeah. One of the things that motivated me to start Bulletproof, and I'm a tech entrepreneur, and I've been hacking my body for a long time, so I have some background on this. It's that every time I see food and supplements and everything else, there's cost optimization, and then there's basically flavor optimization.
Yes.
Right. And when you get to flavor optimization, you've created addictive stuff. You know, when I see the slogan, "You can't eat just one," I'm like,
it's an instruction.
It's a drug.
And it's an instruction. Look, I'm telling you, you can't eat just once.
It's true. In fact, can't is one of my four big weasel words. Anytime one of the Bulletproof employees says can't, I'm like, weasel word.
That's
and
it.
My kids are trained, if I say can't, they, Dad, you're lying. Good. All right. So, with you there. But as a as an instruction and also just as an addictive kind of thing, you'll make more money in a restaurant if you make addictive food. And if you make food that satisfies you, so you're like, wow, I just don't really want to eat anything else. I don't even crave dessert. You might make less money unless you change other things about your model.
It's a bummer.
Yeah.
I'm a capitalist, and I watched the deformation of what happens to health when capital is applied to it, it bums me out as a capitalist. But then somebody pointed out, this is not capitalism, this is crony capitalism. And this is what's happened. I'm actually making a film about this called Feckless this year, that the CEO of Overstock is asked me to do in funding. And it, you know, when we watch how 80 years ago we've transferred so much power to Washington, that it's really starting about 80 years ago, that it made sense to have lobbyists in Washington protecting you. And so the more we move power from state and local governments to Washington, the more, you know, this has happened. Well, the Democrats always wanted a big government to protect us from big business, but they never imagined what would happen when government became a subsidiary of big business, which is really what's happened. And so this is a bipartisan issue. We've got to move power back to state and local governments and away from what's a regulatory capture, where these guys, they're not in the market like you and I. We're out there creating value and attracting people and building a brand and carving out a niche. They're skipping all that and legislating it. And it happens in vaccines where we make my product, I can't be sued for it, and the law says your child has to take it and the state pays me for it. That's not what you and I are in.
There's also the notion of harm reduction. And when you put regulations in place that create a framework where you're not allowed to admit that there's a potential for harm, you can't reduce it. Right? I said can't. But at least you can, but you're breaking the law to reduce it. And there are people who, before they vaccinate their kids, they give their kids extra vitamin C. They give them other antioxidants that protect the liver and try and reduce inflammation because they're worried about it. Now, that's a rational response, and maybe if anyone ever bothered to test a protocol like that, you might find that it reduced adverse incidents. But if you deny adverse incidents...
But there are no adverse incidents, so why would you do anything like that?
How do you make it better? And this is what bothers me. Like even another real contentious issue, are EMFs harmful? I've done enough research on this. Sometimes, yes. In fact, I have equipment in my house that improves the rate of healing using EMFs. And I know that if I can make it help, I can make it
harder.
Like, it's there.
Yeah, I just bought a Beamer bed.
Oh, there you go. Nice. So you understand some of the EMF, both benefits and risks. But if we acknowledge this problem, okay, we've got $40 billion in wireless equipment, or probably more than that out there now. If we acknowledge the problem, we could then change the protocols. I'm a network engineer by background. We change the protocols to be ones that actually help people or at least don't harm them. But by denying risks, we become unscientific. And just saying, look, there's risks and there's benefits. I dearly love having the ability to have a computer in my pocket, and I don't really want to give that up. But if I had a computer in my pocket that made me grow new stem cells instead of cancer cells, that'd be kind of legit. Right, so I just want some scientific honesty across GMOs, across vaccines, across EMFs, and all the other stuff that are flashpoints for people getting angry. And why would you get angry about that? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And if you're getting angry about that, you got to wonder, what programming are you running? Because it's not thinking programming.
So this is where people like you, I love the Bulletproof example. This is where there are, it's funny, when I worked with software developers and people out, I encountered a group of logical people that were logical to a level I'd never encountered before. And you see now, people are moving into executive levels and C-level CEO spots that are coming out of the IT department, or coming out of programming. And it's because of this logical thinking will save us. It needs voices like yours, and it needs a crowd, it needs crowdfunding, it needs... This is, it's not just technology will save us. And again, I'll quote Dan Sullivan, what's his deal is all improvement starts with truth. You know, step one is to tell the truth. And you get people that have, you know, a bias toward logic and intelligence. We can work our way out of this.
There's also the flip side. I wrote a post on it a couple of years ago, and one side of like the health, the soft side of the healing profession, you get sort of the open heart, open mind, but you open your mind so much that your brain falls out.
And, yes.
Right, okay. That's one side of things. I call it the land of the lotus eaters, right? Mm-hmm. But you go to the other far extreme of like super hardcore skeptic rationalism, and you get to the point where you're a robot. And
if it doesn't fit in a test tube, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And when you have to look at it, so this making films on alternative health, I got, you know, when you swing open the door to alternative health, there's no telling who will come in.
And this is one crazy people.
Yeah, this is one of the things we really have to. But there, it turns out, your thinking does affect your body directly.
Yeah.
Electromagnetic fields do affect your body. There are frequencies and wavelengths that can, you know, NASA uses them. You know, I have a stem cell setting on my Beamer bit. You know, it's like, this is just, it really does, you know, work. So, this is where rational thought, and I have to apply it when I decide who do I allow to be in one of my films, because some of it is so, and who's, maybe they're right, but.
I'm sure some people on both extremes are right. I spend a lot of my own conscious energy on walking the line down the middle. I don't want to fall into the land of robots, and I don't want to fall into the land of lotus eaters, because there's great value from people who spend their entire day in ashrams meditating, and they figure out something neat, and then it becomes translatable to a general population who isn't going to live in an ashram. And there's also great value to hardcore scientists who are, you know, looking at quantum interactions and saying, well, damn, I didn't know that worked, but here's a truth table, and it's real. So, but if you deny either side of that, or you only live in one camp, it's like you're a Republican or Democrat. Like, neither side is very accurate.
My phrase is, God bless the lunatic fringe.
Yeah.
Because that's what creates this space in the middle to flourish.
That's where progress seems to happen, is where you listen, but don't always believe either side.
Great point.
We're nearing the end of the show, and there's a question that I've asked every guest on the show. And given your path as an entrepreneur, as a crowdfunder, as just a human being, the three pieces of advice you'd offer for people who want to perform better at whatever it is they do. So if you want to kick more ass, do these three things.
So first off, I'm an introvert, and by the end of the day, I don't have any energy to talk to another human being because I spend my day pretending to be an extrovert. And it burns up energy. It's, you know, to, like, literally, I'm not, but number one is you shouldn't be siloed. You've got to be out. Success comes from relationships, from other people, from, and so often we get so focused on our own projects that we forget to build relationships. And now at my age, my Rolodex is my most valuable Rolodex. My contact.
Rolo what?
I know.
It's like an album?
It's like, well, let me tell you something, Sonny.
I get it.
My contact list, it's not just contact list, it's the relationships that I built. And so number one, focus on relationships. Number two is a sub point of that, is it's not about what they can do for you, it's about what you can do for them. What they can do for you will always work itself out, assuming you're associating with the right kind of people. And then the third thing is not, has nothing to do with productivity, but it's always pay your withholding tax.
That's and great advice.
I'm serious. Like, when I go and look at a business, sometimes people want to invest in a business or a business is in trouble, and I learned to ask the question, so have you paid your withholding? And you see this sheepish look, and you find out there's this $100,000 or $200,000 or $1 million withholding tax liability. And the reason this is important, this is the one, you can go broke and it's okay. You can dust yourself off and start over. That particular tax will pierce through to you personally, and you can't run away from it.
You can go to jail over
it. You
that
can
too.
Go to jail yeah. over it. And so this is where, when people, there are risks to take as an entrepreneur. Don't take risk that can ruin your life. Don't take risk. And that's really the point three is know what your risks are, and don't take stupid risks that can follow you and haunt you. It's our business becomes so important, none of them are really worth that.
Amazing advice. Where can people find info about your latest film, your other films? Like, where can they find more about
you? You can jeffhayesfilms.com.
Spell that for everyone.
It's J-E-F-F-H-A-Y-S, no E in Hayes. Jeff Hayes Films with an S.com. And then individual movies, you can link to from there. I got shortlisted for an Academy Award on Native Soil. So, I mean, I'm a legitimate documentarian. Yeah. This is not a guy with a camera. Hey, I bet I can make a movie.
Yeah, there's a difference between real documentaries and you sort of, I'm on a mission, but I've just got a camera. You're making
although
real films.
Sometimes the people that, you know, are on a mission and have a camera, you end up going, dang, that's good.
It's a fair point.
Yeah.
It does happen.
Yeah, I hate that, but it's true.
Thanks for being on the show. We're going to include all the links to Jeff's movies. They're worth watching, Doctored on Native Soil, and your very latest one.
Bot,
and you've got Fahrenheit 9/11 as well. So this is a long history of these things, and we'll post links to jeffhayesfilms.com. If you enjoyed the show, I would really appreciate it if you would head on over to iTunes and say you like it, and just share it with others. We're just about at 11 million downloads, and I'm putting a ton of time and energy into this because I think it's helping a lot of people. So if this helped you, whether as an entrepreneur or as someone interested in all of these cool things we just got to talk about, just head on over and let me know that it's making a difference because that keeps me motivated. And also let other people know that you thought it was worth your time. It just takes a second to go to iTunes and click. Thank you.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.